Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 28th September 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish. And we're delighted to be joined by David Scott. And of course, David reporting from north of the border with northern exposure. But we're kicking off with fracking, and Ian Crane is with us also.
Well, yes, indeed. So on Wednesday, three fracking protectors jailed. On the 26th, the judge's name was Robert Altham. So he sentenced three fracking protesters to 16 and 15 months imprisonment in Preston Crown Court. They had climbed on top of lorries at the Preston New Road frack site, and it stayed up there for 4 days. So two of them were sentenced to 16 months, one to 15 months. There was a fourth defendant who received a suspended sentence for 12 months. But if we say welcome to the programme, Ian, these guys were not your average environmental protesters as such. I mean, they were professionals.
Absolutely, Mike. And thanks for the invitation to join you today. Yes, the three that have been jailed were Rich Loiseau, who is actually from Devon, and he's very active at Schumacher College, and he also teaches at the Acorn a Special Learning Centre. And he's 31-year-old. As far as I'm aware, no previous history of any direct activism. He was joined by Simon Blevins, who's a 26-year-old soil scientist, and Richard Roberts, a 36-year-old piano restorer. And as you say, the fourth one, Julian Brock, also from Devon, but he had pleaded guilty. So he got a suspended sentence in return for pleading guilty. But, you know, these are, as far as I'm aware, the first people to be imprisoned for environmental protest, basically well over a century. You know, much is made of the five people who were jailed following the Kinder Scout invasion back in 1932. But those guys were jailed because of their participation in an affray with the gamekeepers. These were peaceful protesters who simply climbed on the vehicles to cause Quadrilla some delay. And I regret to say that at the time when I realized that they were being left up there by the police, I sensed that they were being set up to bring about custodial sentences. And obviously the intent is to put the fear into people and prevent them from participating in any environmental activism. But I just want to put something in perspective, Mike, with regards to this particular judge. Because he decided to defer sentencing following the hearing on Tuesday, where he heard submissions from both the Crown Prosecution and the legal teams representing these individuals. And he decided that he would defer the sentencing until the following morning. So one was hoping that he was going to sleep on it and that common sense would prevail. But I sensed that he got a phone call and probably took an instruction from elsewhere. But Judge Robert Altham, and I'm going to refer to two of his previous cases, one in September 2016, where he found a paedophile who had 10,000 indecent images. 684 of those images were regarded as the most serious. And, you know, this was an individual who the judge at the time said it's beyond any reasonable person to understand how anyone could gain any sort of gratification from watching a person perform a sexual offence on a child. And he made the observation that one of these images was a child who could be no more than 2 or 3 years old. And the Judge Altham said in his closing remarks, he said, for that reason, you ought to be thoroughly ashamed of yourself. But then he went on to sentence this pedophile to 9 months in jail, but suspended for 12 months and just simply placed him on curfew for 30 weeks. And then in June of 2017, in a similar case, he had a guy by the name of Keith Harley, who also had 254 Category A images, 170 Category B images, and 33,704 Category C images, most involved girls between the ages of 8 and 10. And Judge Altham sentenced Keith Harley to 12 months in jail, suspended for 2 years, and ordered him to complete 250 hours of unpaid work. So let's put this in perspective. You know, the three guys who were jailed on Wednesday for surfing the trucks outside at Preston New Road had not committed any act of violence, or certainly not any sexual offence, and yet they are sentenced to 16 and 15 months respectively, and yet crass, gross paedophiles he allows to walk free with suspended sentence. And, you know, the conclusion that one draws from this is that in corporatist UK, paedophilia is far more socially acceptable, well, it is to the judiciary anyway, than peaceful activism, where people feel sufficiently motivated to take these actions to prevent the bigger crime of the ecocide and the inevitable negative health impacts that will occur from fracking. And in a perverse statement, in sentencing these three guys on Wednesday, Judge Altham said, "The defendants have a serious concern for the environment, but see the public as necessary and justified collateral damage," which is somewhat absurd, because that's exactly how the unconventional gas companies view the 10 million plus people who live in the sacrifice zone in the north of England. They just want to get on, frack the geology, and with total disregard for the collateral impact on the wider community.
Okay, and thank you very much for that. Now, just to finish off, do these guys have any opportunity for appeal?
Yes, I'm sure that the appeals are being prepared as we speak. Of course, provided they keep their noses clean, and there's no reason to suggest they won't. In the worst case, they would serve half these sentences, with the other half being under license. But, you know, it's really important that people who maybe don't have any real concerns or interest in the issue.
And with that, we have
this very thin end of a fat wedge, and indicates that the civil liberties that people believe they have a right to enjoy are being removed.
Okay, Ian, thank you very much for that report. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again soon, no doubt. Maybe fracking nightmare next Thursday, perhaps?
Most definitely next Thursday. I will be in court in London challenging the IGAS injunction on Tuesday, and I'll be heading back to the studio for Thursday next week.
Superb. Okay, see you then. Thank you for joining us. Let's move on, Brian, unless you've got a comment.
Well, I feel I need to comment, because it is so evident that we do not have a justice system in UK anymore. It's a system to protect the wealthy, the rich, to protect corporate interests. And the point was made there. You can have abused children, collateral damage, but you can't go near a fracking company.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on then to, the Skripal case. And, good news, Brian, because the BBC a couple of days ago said Skripal suspect was made hero of Russia by President Putin. So that is a statement. It's not a speculative statement. They admit it, put that down
it's
as fact. A fact.
It's coming from the BBC.
So that's quite interesting. And what was this story all about? Well, of course, Bellingcat, the open source research and investigative research organization, so-called, has decided that they have identified one of the suspects in the Skripal poisoning case. So the BBC saying a Russian man accused of the Salisbury poisoning is a military officer who received an honour from Vladimir Putin, an investigative website says. Following the attempted poisoning in March, UK investigators identified one of the two suspects as Ruslan Bashirov. President Putin claimed Bashirov was a civilian, and in Russia TV, he himself said he visited as a tourist, as Bashirov is a bit bad English there. But anyway, the website Bellingcat says he's actually an intelligence officer by the name of Colonel Anatoly Chapiga. So that's what we know, Chapiga. Of course, who have we got here? Tom Watson, the deputy leader of the Labour Party. He thinks this is great. He said the revelation that one of the Skripal poisoning suspects is a highly decorated Russian colonel and not an innocent cathedral spotter is fresh proof that Britain is now at the sharp end of an assault ordered personally by Putin. Clearly, we now need overhaul of national security strategy to protect our democracy from Putin's hybrid warfare. Our investigating authorities have done their job in identifying the Salisbury assassins. Now we need a Mueller-style probe into Russian interference in our democracy. That's very interesting. He is suggesting that our investigating authorities have done their job in identifying the Salisbury assassins. I don't think they have, unless we're now saying that Bellingcat is one of our investigating authorities. So here is the Bellingcat website, and the headline there, Skripal suspect Bashirov identified as GRU Colonel Anatoly Chapiga. Well, Patrick Henningsen highlighted this to me, because as you scroll down this particular article, we get this image. And the image is tagged on the website as being Memorial Wall of the Far East Military Command School with Colonel Chapiga as the last name under Gold Star Honor List. And so the question is then, if Chapiga's name is on a memorial wall, what would that mean? Does that mean that perhaps he's dead? Because I'm not aware of anybody, any country producing memorial walls with the names of soldiers that are still alive on them, even if they've been awarded medals. They tend to be only for dead people, but apparently the BBC doesn't feel the need to ask that. So what was Craig Murray saying about it? Well, here's his website today. He said Kommersant has published interviews with people from Chapiga's home village. The article makes it clear he's not been seen there for many years. Of course, there's many reasons why he may not have been seen there, but potentially one of the reasons is that he's dead. It states that opinions differ on whether Chapiga is Bashirov. One woman says she recognised Bashirov as Chapiga when he appeared on TV, especially the dark eyes, though she had not seen him since she was at school. Another woman states that it's not Chapiga, as when she last saw him 10 years ago, he was already pretty bald. And he has a more open face, although the eyes are similarly brown. So Craig Murray here making the point that, of course, mainstream media are taking one person's testimony and not the other. But also Craig Murray makes this point. He says the problem with Bellingcat's methodology is that they did not start with any prior intelligence that Chapiga is Bashirov. They rather allegedly researched databases of GRU operatives of about the right age, then trawled photos of yearbooks of them until they found one that looked a bit like Bashirov. And guess what? It does look a bit like Bashirov if you ignore the substantial differences of skull shape and nose, right? And he goes on to make the point that if you actually use facial recognition software on these two faces, you get very different results between them. They do not conclude that it's the same person. He says there's a superficial resemblance, but if you take standard ratios used for facial recognition, you get a very different story. Well, Dmitry Peskov, who's the presidential spokesman for the Kremlin, said, he said many people look alike. And really, I haven't seen anything yet that proves that this man is who they say he is. And really, Bellingcat's only evidence in their article is the photograph. They have no other evidence. The rest of the article is establishing Chapiga's military record. And they're not, they're absolutely not providing any evidence other than the photographs themselves. Now, BBC had a second article yesterday entitled Bellingcat, the website behind the Skripal revelation. So Bellingcat getting a big chuck up by the BBC. This is a really important organisation, apparently, and we should absolutely respect them. But the question is, who is Elliot Higgins, born in 1979 in Leicester? Well, Newsweek in 2015 said, sipping a can of beer and devouring French fries in a Brussels hotel room, Elliot Higgins doesn't look like the type to get involved in armed conflicts. The Englishman has a baby face, slumped shoulders and a soft Midlands accent. But over the past 3 years, the 36-year-old former administrator and obsessive gamer has spent hundreds of hours scouring the internet to find out the truth about faraway wars, from the use of chemical weapons in Syria to Russian troops invading Ukraine, all from the comfort of his couch. And Brian, this reminds me very much of the Syrian Observatory on Human Rights, yeah, for example. Another Foreign and Commonwealth Office asset, which, you know, who is one person that, that operates from their couch. Now, there are lots of comments on Elliot Higgins on various mainstream media websites. He never finished college. He dropped out of technical college. He was once a payments officer at a woman's underwear company, according to The Independent. Off Guardian says that even casual observation with him reveals the embarrassing truth that his research, so lauded in the popular media, consists of entry-level computer skills and an awful lot of smoke blowing. You or I, or literally anyone over the age of 7 with internet access, could do it if we thought it was worthwhile. But he does continue to get widespread coverage in the mainstream media. Somehow he's, despite all the apparent shortcomings, he's contributed to Atlantic Council papers and reports. And Patrick Henningsen, again, making the point here to me that Bellingcat itself is no longer a one-man band. The organization is running training courses for intelligence recruits. He's running training courses for mainstream media junior investigators in the US and Europe. He lectures at Georgetown University part-time, and possibly running an open source group at King's College. And now he's established, according to Patrick, an operations room in The Hague with many Dutch contractors, ex-gamers. He's a gamer. He's employed a lot of ex-gamers. Also recently seems to have hired many Russian speakers. And Patrick believes that he's built his own source, the Insider Russia. Now, the Insider Russia was cited in the Bellingcat article. And it's a very, it's a name which is designed, I believe, to confuse people, because, of course, there is another long-standing publication called Russian Insider. So Patrick's saying that this is a team to trawl through Russian data online and generate evidence for the US and the UK. All in all, Bellingcat is a fairly decent-sized, small quango adjunct of intelligence Five Eyes, and that certainly seems to be the case, Brian.
It does. I've got a little bit of comment on this, which I'll do very quickly in just a moment. Perhaps we should just bring David in for comment. It is just unbelievable, this story, and the way it's being pushed forward by the British government. Of course, many people in our chat room today are just saying that they're sick and tired of what they're calling nonsense. How do you feel about it?
Well, unbelievable is correct. The as well as the completely inconsistent response on the ground, you know, the hazmat suits in some cases, no protection in others, people in the ordinary police uniform standing next to allegedly infected door handles with weapons grade high level nerve agent, the fact that the response of the people affected wasn't correct for a high level weapons grade nerve agent. All of this is bizarre. And what's the alleged reason that the Russians are doing this? What's Putin doing it for? There is no rationale to it at all. None of it makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah.
None of it makes sense, but I have got some good news, because I came in at this story from a slightly different angle this morning. So let's put the BBC article up. Now, remember that if the BBC says something, they're publicity and media team have told me on several occasions, if we, the BBC, report it, you can take it that it is factually correct, and you don't need to know the BBC journalist even if we, the BBC, publish if it's true. And of course, if you read the BBC's reports, they rely on Bellingcat 100%. That means to me that we're all due to get an enormous financial rebate, and let me explain how this works. Because now we have Bellingcat, all of the rest of UK's intelligence services are redundant. MI5 couldn't solve this mystery. GCHQ couldn't solve it. MI6 couldn't solve it. None of the UK agencies could solve it, but this man can. So what we're going to do, Mike, is we're going to get rid of all the agencies. They're simply not needed anymore. And once we've got rid of them, what we find is that we've got a £2.9 billion budget to spread across every man and woman in the country. That's roughly £44.
So for every man, woman and child.
Indeed, yeah. a minimum, because I don't believe that 2.9 billion, which is the figure I found, is actually correct. I believe it is much, much higher. But we can look forward to about £44 per head. This we showed on Monday because this was Gavin talking about yet more cyber capability for the military.
Don't need that.
We don't need that either. That can all go due to Bellingcat. And if there's somebody out there who's good with financial figures, then you can find online the Security and Intelligence Agency's financial statement. This is where I got that figure of 2.9 billion from. But this is very weaselly worded. So I think there's more money there. We can have more money back to the public when all of these agencies are scrapped and we bring in Bellingcat.
Good stuff. Well, let's go back to the UN General Assembly because Theresa May gave her speech yesterday. So let's just have a brief look at that. This is what she said. Putin did it. Anyone who says otherwise will be silenced. We'll continue to start wars overseas via UK aid. Putin did it. Did I tell you that Putin did it? That's a quick summary of what she said, but that's there was nothing else in her speech. Well, what was Sergei Lavrov saying? He said this, we call on London again to establish a fruitful dialogue for establishing truth. This, of course, is over the Skripal affair. Well, based on Theresa May's speech, there's not much danger of that because Putin did it. Lavrov went on to say, the situation in the OPCW is degrading as our Western counterparts seek to impose the so-called attributing functions on a technical secretariat. And of course, it is the case that that although the OPCW has not yet attributed blame for anything, this is the situation. They have the ability now to attribute blame. He went on to say, in doing this, they violate grossly the Chemical Weapons Convention and meddle with the prerogatives of the UN Security Council. Well, somebody who was speaking on the same day as Donald Trump, because Theresa May spoke the day afterwards, was Emmanuel Macron, the president of France. And here he is. And he really was not very happy with what Donald Trump had to say and sort of tried to rebut it somewhat. He said, everyone here today inherits hope, the hope of preserving future generations from the scourge of war, building a new world order based on law and keeping good on our word. Keeping good on our word to whom? On their word to us, the people, or to somebody else, to the banks? I'm not quite sure what he meant by that. But he went on to say this. Today we're seeing a far-reaching crisis, a crisis of the Westphalian world order of the past. The Westphalian world order apparently is in the past, that's it. This world order failed to regulate itself economically, financially, and on climate change, for example. Well, this rhetoric out of Macron is very similar to rhetoric that we've seen from Tony Blair, in fact. In a speech that he gave a number of years ago, he said, before September 11th, I was already reaching for a different philosophy in international relations from a traditional one that has held sway since the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648. So he was talking about building a new system of international relations, just as Macron is. Very similar language being used. Let's just remind ourselves what the Treaty of Westphalia was about, that there should be a Christian and universal peace and a perpetual, true and sincere amity, that this peace and amity be observed and cultivated through such a sincerity and zeal that each party shall endeavour to procure the benefit, honour and advantage of the other, and thus on all sides they may see this peace and friendship flourish by entertaining a good and faithful neighbourhood. This has been the basis of the nation state since the 17th century. And in fact, it, in a sense, it's a restatement of an already established situation. But nonetheless, you know, if we were running our foreign policy on this basis, Brian, I think we'd be in a much better situation. And, you know, I've shown this before, but I just want to remind everybody, if you listen to Xi Jinping's speeches over the last few years, the language is very similar in the sense of being Westphalian in nature. So we've got Western leaders moving away from the Westphalian model of international relations. Xi absolutely seems to be living in the Westphalian model of international relations. And if you listen to what Trump had said it was pretty similar as well. So we seem, David, to have a split developing between various leaders around the world on which is the best international model. And as we pointed out the other day, Trump in particular, very keen to see the back of certain international institutions.
Yes, Trump's very much off script. Now, this is the international rules-based order, which is a legalistic approach. This obviously raises some question. Who makes the rules? Well, the rules are not made in any way in which the ordinary man or woman can exert any influence. So the ordinary man or woman is just having to comply. And who enforces the rules? So you're talking about an inherent threat of violence, one nation against presumably all others, right? So this is the promise of the UN, will have peace because anyone who breaks the peace will have intervention from the entire international community. So there is something, particularly when you don't know what the rules are and who is making them and who is influencing them behind the scenes, there is something extremely sinister about this, because on a more local level, and the nation being the largest example of that, there is some common feeling, there is some mutual regard, and there's sufficient understanding of what the society is about that people can have influence and people can have some degree of confidence as to where their legal system is going to take them, what the society stands for. The rules-based international order is one which is imposed on the people from above, is entirely top-down, unlike the common law in Britain, which is much more bottom-up, and that's the big difference.
Absolutely. Well, just before we leave this, I just wanted to highlight the difference in
attendance.
This was the day of Trump and Macron speaking. So people clearly interested in what they had to say, no matter what you might think of that, a large attendance there. I just wanted to highlight the difference with Theresa's attendance. So this was Theresa May giving her speech. If you watch...
a few people getting up and walking out.
Absolutely. So nobody in the room for Theresa May at all, at least a fraction of the number of people. Nobody really cared what she had to say. But anyway, just before we leave the UN General Assembly, I just wanted to highlight this as well. This is La Verità, an Italian news outlet. And the headline is, to avoid sanctions on Iran, we keep our feet in both camps. That's a pretty rough translation of it. If Alex Thompson is watching, he'll probably shoot me for that one. But anyway, the article says Giuseppe Conte met with Hassan Rouhani with the aim of protecting Italian business in Iran without annoying the United States. They're saying that abandoning the Mogherini line, the Italian government's hope is to be a mediator between Washington and Tehran. It was this that amused me somewhat here, because they don't call him Donald Trump. They don't say Mr. Trump. It's the Donald in this publication. So the Donald has silenced the world with results. The elite's only remaining weapon is contempt, they say. So in this article, they are quoting a U.S. diplomatic source who's saying Washington cannot completely drop Iran for security reasons. And in the current scenario, Italy represents the perfect bridge, including because only Italy amongst major European countries showed willingness to work with Trump's United States. So, despite the fact that Trump spent quite a bit of his speech on at the start of the week criticizing Iran and being quite bullish towards Iran, there's clearly other stuff going on in the back channel as well.
Yeah.
So let's see, where are we now? Let's move to Scottish issues. And David, we're starting off with The Spectator here. The headline is, In Defence of Smacking Children.
Yes, so I'll just read a couple of paragraphs from this. This is an article by Brendan O'Neill in The Spectator. And he writes, Scotland is fast becoming the most unforgiving nanny state in the West. A world leader in the policing of people's beliefs and lifestyles, it has in recent years passed laws telling football fans what they're allowed to sing and chant. It has banned smoking in cars and parks. And it said it wants to make Scotland smoke-free by 2034. It has introduced the named person scheme, whereby every bairn will have a state official keeping an eye on them from birth to the age of 18, brackets George Orwell called, he wants his storyline back, close brackets, And now this little republic of rulemaking plans to ban parents from smacking their kids. And he goes on to explain that if good normal parents find themselves punished on the basis that they behave violently, and what this will do to the relationships and dynamics within families. He says it will make parents feel ashamed. It might even criminalise them. It will pit kids against the mothers. I'm telling the police on you. They'll say it will further throw open the family home and the family itself to the prying eyes of the police and the bureaucrats. It is a disaster. And he's spot on. It's also worth remembering, we did a piece called Curiouser and Curiouser a short time ago on the column. This was looking at the origin of this, and of course the man most central to the anti-smacking movement has now been convicted for paedophilia. That is Peter Newell. So that's also a strange quirk in the story. So there are people speaking out against this latest state intervention, including Stuart Wayton, who is a lecturer at Abertay University. So he's also been speaking on this subject, and he's been pointing out a couple of inconsistencies, because he's stated that, well, the person bringing this in, which is John Swinney, he smacked his children when he was when they were younger, and he confirms that the children are fine, but he also confirms that this is now to be viewed as domestic violence. And he then says, although it's being viewed as domestic violence, and it is domestic violence, but parents won't be criminalised if you believe that.
So, David, if this becomes a criminal offence, then people are going to end up in courts. They're going to end up being punished by judges.
And they're going to take the children away, and the children are going to be abused in care. But that's not a problem, because we've got judges releasing paedophiles.
Exactly.
Yes, I mean, this is one of the examples. And so Stuart Wayton was asking us, do we make this retrospective? As the person who actually brought in this legislation or this idea, does he have to be arrested? Do we have to start looking at the backstory? It makes no sense at all. And rather than having the sovereignty and independence of family life protected, again, you see the state muscling in. And they're imposing one method of parenting on everybody, and on every child, because there can be only one. It must be uniform. And the result is obviously a further attack on family life. Now, this next slide is on the general subject of we are the Scottish government. We will tell you how to think. This is the latest campaign. OK, so here we have Humza Yousaf, and they've found a Police Scotland senior officer who seems to be of South Asian descent. So I think it's positive discrimination for why he's in there. That might be a crime, I'm not sure. And we've got also dear Miss Campbell, who was the original instigator of the name person scheme before it cost her job at that point. Aileen also Campbell is her name, because she famously said that parents also have a role in bringing up their children. So they're sending a message to the haters. So this is the Police Scotland and the Scottish Government are going to eliminate hate. So we're going to eliminate an emotion. We're going to police emotions. We're going to police ideas. We're going to police thoughts, not actions. Right? Now, I have to be quite clear here. If someone is assaulted, that's a crime. They need to be protected. They need to be protected by the society. We should each of us be prepared to stand next to someone who's being assaulted and defend them, because the idea of the strong attacking the weak is just horrendous. But that's not what we're talking here. We're talking about controlling how people think. Now, there's an organisation here called the Global Citizen. They were very keen on this little idea. So they're saying it's just brilliant, and Scotland is charging forward and leading the world. And they mention here that putting an end to inequalities and discrimination all around the world, not quite sure how you put an end to inequalities because people are different, but there we go, we're going to do it. It's a key part of the UN's global goals, regardless of someone's race, age, disability, ethnicity, gender, ethnicity is different from race apparently, sexuality or any other status. So anything at all, if you... it gets protected. Scotland is leading the crackdown on hate. So presumably, Nazism, Satanism, all of these things will likewise be protected, because it does say here, any other status. So there we go. And you can join us to support the good people in Scotland. So I had a little look at the UN agenda, because this is where it comes from. None of these ideas originate in Scotland. They all come from further afield, usually America, often the UN. And so we have the UN. There's something like 17 goals, but there's actually only 16, because number 17 is just through the first 16. Goal number 10 is reduced inequalities. And it describes a little bit of what it's about, and it's utterly incoherent. It says, too much of the wealth, of the world's wealth, is held by a very small group of people. Okay, but it doesn't say what the right amount. It says too much. Okay. This often leads to financial and social discrimination. So if you have no money, you're financially discriminated against. You're not just poor, no, you suffer financial discrimination. And it then says, in order for nations to flourish, equality and prosperity must be available to everyone. Well, I point out that in order for nations to flourish, you need a hardworking, honest population and property rights. And actually, that's pretty much all you need. But equality and prosperity must be available to everyone, regardless of race, gender, religious belief, or economic status. So regardless of your economic status, you must have prosperity. And your religious beliefs are all equal. So even if your religious beliefs are that someone with another religious belief deserves to be killed, that's somehow equal. So you see how it becomes rapidly incoherent. It becomes anything that anyone wants it to be. And it then says, the most troubling of all, when every individual is self-sufficient, the entire world prospers. Now, that's a strange thing to say, because none of us are self-sufficient. Self-sufficiency is associated with poverty, because we gain an awful lot from trading and interacting with one another. We live within families, which are very much not self-sufficient, but collectively sufficient. And we have people who, because of disability or other reason, are incapable of being self-sufficient. What happens to them in this brave new world? I don't know. And then the next slide that you put up briefly is some of the targets, and off they go. And they start talking about strange things, including lots of things to do with immigration. We've got here, adopt fiscal policies and social policies that promote equality. So you've got wealth transfers is part of it, so socialism is part of it, built in there. And then it starts to get quite strange, because they talk about responsible, well-managed immigration policies and reduced transaction costs for migrant remittances. So what you're seeing here is, well, yes, it's equality, but actually there's a wider agenda. It's attacking the nation. It's promoting things like immigration and breaking down borders, breaking down any limit.
And it's very serious. I think we still see some people who say this sort of thing is nonsense, it's ridiculous, it's, you know, it's bizarre. But this is very, very calculated legislation and a political agenda in order to create a tyranny. And it's coming in immensely fast. So people, once you see it, it's vital that people warn each other about it and stand up to be counted, because this is coming in like the tide, really.
Yes. So, David, we have a video clip on this issue of discrimination here. Just give us a brief introduction to this.
This is from a gentleman who's a PhD and a member of an American conservative think tank generally operating in the field of defence and international relations. And he's speaking on the matter of discrimination and the policies concerning.
To the OSCE, is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah.
No, now if this was just naive, I wouldn't bother to mock it, but we know by now it's not naive. Any good cultural Marxist knows that protected classes are the new proletariat. That's why the list grows ever longer. Race, justifiably. Gender, ethnicity, national origin, disability, color, creed, sexual orientation, gender identity. And at OSCE, you're against any discrimination. The radicals behind this strategy, hopefully none of whom are in the room, understand that if a government bans any discrimination without bothering to define it, that government will be able to enforce the provision against anyone at any time for any reason. That, Madam Chairman, is totalitarianism.
Wow.
Totalitarianism, David?
Yes, this is the point, right? We're policing how people think. We're policing not how people behave. We're not saying these are the standards for a civilized society. We're not saying things like assault, causing people fear and alarm, are completely unacceptable and acting on the actions. We're now acting on the motivation. And when the government starts inquiring into your motivation, into your innermost thoughts, that is the definition of totalitarianism, and it goes into some very strange places, and there is no limit.
And the Scotsman here is saying that Scotland's next census will include a gender-neutral option. You made an interesting observation to me earlier about this.
Well, yes, because the census is going to ask you a lot of questions about your sexuality. You can choose to be gender-neutral if you wish. So what you see here is the government's inquiring into your private life and is acquiring a lot of data about your private life. When did the government have any interest or any need to know any of this? Now, I don't think that this is long-term safe. For the communities that are being used, the people who are being used as the excuse for this, we must protect the transgender, the whatever victim group is the flavour of the month. Right? Are they actually going to be safer being on a database and being identified by the state? I'm not sure that they are. And the example I gave to you earlier on, Mike, was suppose you had a new version of Nazism. They said, look, we're very sorry about how we treated the Jews. We're going to make it up to them. We're going to protect them. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to get a big database and we're going to identify the location of every Jew in the country. Would that make the Jews feel safer? I don't think it would. The state gathering this information on people so that they can identify every group and every group to which you as an individual might belong. This could be used for many purposes, many of them harmful.
Absolutely. Right. OK, let's move on to Brexit and the Scottish part of this. Police prepared for potential disorders sparked by food shortages post-Brexit. Now, this is similar to the type of rhetoric that we've seen and we've reported from the English press as well. But I thought that that's in the Scotsman. But I thought the Herald's headline was even better. Police ready for chaos as row erupts over possible rationing. So are we bringing back rationing as a result of Brexit now? Is that the latest problem that we're going to be facing?
I think you need to be more afraid, Mike. I don't like that kind of smirk in your voice there. You're meant to be terrified, right? The whole point of this is you're meant to be frightened. When we don't care what's frightening you as long as you're frightened. Right, as long as you're frightened and you appreciate that not going for Brexit and arguing for some sort of accommodation with the EU will protect you from the thing that terrifies you. As long as that's what you conclude, the state will be fine. Yes, I thought it was very strange. A couple of quick points. One, there's been a large pay rise for Police Scotland, and I see that the Chief Constable Livingston has put on quite a few pounds, so it's good to see that he is personally preparing for food rationing by building up fat reserves. So that's good. That's the sort of attention to detail that we need to see in our senior police officers. And also, I would point out the First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, said the appointment exposes the shambolic handling of Brexit and said Tory Brexiteers should be the first to bear the brunt if there ever comes a day when there's food rationing. So I'm not quite sure what that means. Are we going to eat Jacob Rees-Mogg? I'm not quite sure what the first to bear the brunt means in the event of rationing, but there we go. But yes, be afraid.
David, excellent. Let me just add a bit more to Brexit with a smile on my face. I don't think you'll be eating Rees-Mogg because he is a very thin man, but I think he may disappear. BuzzFeed, we don't usually cover in any great detail, but I just had to follow this one through because I was so intrigued. Here we are. These leaked messages show how Tory HQ used a Twitter army to attack Jeremy Corbyn, but they turned on Theresa May instead. And this is an article worth reading. There's Theresa. She's very unhappy because she's now got her own Tory party attacking her. And all of this is tied in with the Tory party trying to be very clever on social media in order to improve its image, which of course is utter rubbish on social media. So I thought a little more information would help. So this is part of the article. As Labour was thrown into crisis over allegations of anti-Semitism this summer, the Conservatives saw an opportunity to score some rare hits against their political rivals on social media. Tory HQ used a private Twitter group called Tory First Battalion to circulate articles attacking Jeremy Corbyn to dozens of their most active online supporters in an attempt to replicate the network of outriders that have been central to the Labour leader's popularity on social media, according to messages shared with BuzzFeed. The First Battalion, which has about 40 members, including Tory councillors, campaigners and former parliamentary candidates, was set up by Tory activists to amplify pro-Conservative and anti-Labour messages. I think that sounds a bit like hate speech, David, but we'll have to come on to that. And then it says, in the eyes of some Conservatives, Central HQ, using the First Battalion would clearly boost the party's Twitter presence by giving it a network of active and loyal volunteers who spread their attack lines. So I thought we could just do this in a diagram. Here's the Conservative campaign HQ. This is the big man running it, Ian Carter. He's interesting because he doesn't really tweet very much. He gets other people to do the dirty work. But here he is, Ian Carter, Conservative Party political director. This is straight out of the Soviet Union from my era. So they set up the First Battalion. Remember, this is an army supposedly bigging up the Conservatives and attacking the general public, really, because it's surfing. And the target was Corbyn. But in fact, it all backfired because here he is. We'll call him the tall, thin sausage for you, David. His army got it all wrong. And they unleashed all their Twitter skills on Theresa, dropping a big bomb on her. So this is all pretty sad. But on serious things, we've learnt this morning that the government's papers come out on defence. Now, this supposedly took into account the paper that was submitted by David Ellis from Strategic Defence Initiatives, Alex Thompson and the UK column. I haven't had time to go through it all, but if you go to the end, just a complete whitewash, because the government says, yes, we are going to keep our MPs informed as to what we're doing regards defence and security partnerships with Europe. But of course, this is an utter lie. And the lie is so big because we've had to put an article out, which was posted late last night, I think, talking about the deceit carried on away from the British public by the Franco-British Council to bring in this unified EU military structure. So I encourage you to get on the website. Also have a look at this article by Mike, which is warning about what's happening with the corporate media now beginning to attack social media. We must pay. You can freeze the screen to have a little look at that. But the subject I want to end on, watching the clock, is that Tommy Robinson was in court yesterday. He's free at the moment. I need a bit more detail on what the actual judgment was. What interests me is he and many supporters were holding Melanie Shaw posters, banners. And when we go into the mainstream media, Melanie is censored. There's no question of this, Mike. You can see here very clearly Tommy Robinson has that banner. Somebody's got it in the back, but the only shot they show is with Melanie's name cut out. Yeah. And so the fact is that Melanie has disappeared at the moment. We know she's in Style prison and she is still there, although it's been now accepted by the court system that she should have some mental health support and she would be better off in another location. She's still being held in prison. And we know it is absolutely true that at particular points her medical team were denied, her legal team were denied access to her. So if Tommy Robinson is feeling hard done by, Melanie Shaw signifies many, many other people brutalised by the British state. David, 10 seconds and we must end.
Well, it's remarkable. We're seeing Tommy Robinson, for whatever you think, whether you're pro or against, we see him standing up for Melanie Shaw, which is the right thing to do. We see people who are supporting him also pointing at Melanie Shaw. Remember, Melanie has nothing to do with Islamic gangs or anything else. and we see the media consistently turning away and not wanting to tell the public what's actually happening in the country.
Yep. David, thank you very much for joining us. That's it. Thank you to our audience and our listeners today. Thank you for joining UK Column. If you like what we do, please subscribe and or donate. We can only do what we do with your help. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.